In this talk, I'll start it from the end. The end can be spoken of as emptiness. A very rich word, and I'll point to some of its meanings and implications. And we discussed a little bit before coming here the phenomena or very basic human tendency and direction of thirst or hunger. Let's say thirst for now. And need. And now, speaking about emptiness, I'm reminded of a line from Rumi, pretty simply saying, emptiness is what your heart is looking for. And for many of the great teachers in the tradition, the answer for the question, what's the deepest thing, the most liberating thing that the Dharma can offer? The answer will be emptiness. The great Tibetan teacher, Jamgon Nipam, points to the final or fundamental nature of things, saying, by its own very nature, appearance is essentially emptiness. Things, whatever is appeared, whatever is sensed, is essentially emptiness. And what is emptiness? Maybe before I'll continue, it's worth saying that Robert Bass, my teacher's book, Seeing That Freeze, is centered and around this theme and elaborates it to a great extent. And I'm just saying that in case you're listening and thinking, it sounds interesting, but I need to understand much more. So you'll know there is an address. There is a direction to go into and an authority to ask. Before saying what emptiness is, I can say what it is not, or just a little bit of what it is not. Emptiness does not mean the lack of things and does not mean space. This is not what emptiness means. And this would usually be the first thing that a person would imagine when they hear the word emptiness. It's the lack of something, or it is void, or it is space. But this is not what the word emptiness in the Buddhist tradition means. In the Buddhist tradition, the word emptiness is a short term for the phrase empty of inherent existence. And it is not a particular experience or a form of experiencing. We need to be careful. It's not a particular experience, but it's a characteristic of appearances. So everything that is seen, heard, sensed, felt, including perhaps a sense of space, including perhaps a sense of consciousness, including the sense of time, everything carries the characteristic, or its most fundamental characteristic, is emptiness. that may be similar in its in the quality of being a characteristic to the characteristic of change, of anicca. Everything is changing. Similarly to that, everything is empty. It's a very different characteristic, but it's a characteristic of things. So change, anicca, is not a particular experience, but it's an angle of things. Emptiness is an angle of things. So again, Mipham says appearances and emptiness are inseparable, pointing to emptiness being that characteristic. And this angle of things is not something that is easy to see or understand. But it is fundamental if one is looking for and interested in awakening. The Buddha says, one who knows with regards to the world that all this is not real, abandons the near shore and the far, like a snake, its worn out old skin. In order to build a bridge and begin to understand and be able to communicate with this slightly mysterious term or mysterious characteristic of things, we can introduce the vehicle that the Buddha very generously and wisely suggested to this seeing. This is a rich vehicle, a complex one, an extremely interesting one. And the travel on it is liberating from the beginning, in the middle, and definitely towards the end. The Buddha called this vehicle dependent origination and said, whoever sees dependent arising sees the Dhamma. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees dependent arising. Dependent arising being the vehicle for this deep seeing of emptiness. And I can also say, and I should also say, that it may be that alongside this primary vehicle of dependent origination, the ways of practice, the paths that Catherine suggested yesterday, when followed and developed, can also be a slightly different, slight variation of a vehicle leading to deep understanding, deep realization of emptiness, maybe with a different take or different style. But if we'll go back to the high street, I think you said, the main road of dependent origination. There is absolutely no way in which I will, in this talk, which I still aspire won't be very long, will go in depth to all that this term encompasses. And again, if you're interested in that, I would highly recommend going and reading Seeing That Frees, even if it's a project that would take a few years to really go in depth into the amazing liberating understanding that can come from practices around dependent origination. leading to this seeing of emptiness. But very fortunately, the Dharma is coherent. The Dharma is coherent. It means that however one practices the Dharma, they will be able to see and understand dependent origination and to some extent understand emptiness through their practice. However they are doing that practice, assuming it's in line with the Dharma and assuming they know what to look for when they're doing their practice. And there are two very simple principles, or relatively simple principles that we can look for and understand that will start to show us the dynamics of dependent origination and lead the way to seeing of the emptiness of things. One, is that our mind is always involved in what we perceive and experience. It is always involved in what we perceive and experience. You cannot experience anything without your mind and heart being involved in that. That's not so hard to understand, isn't it? It's like, yeah, you say that. But it's worth to keep an eye out and really notice it. Whenever there is clinging to something, pushing and pulling of something, there's probably some denial or unseeing, lack of seeing, in the way my heart and my mind are now participating and taking part in the creation of this thing that I'm clinging to. And with that seeing, the clinging can get less. Or with the lessening of clinging, there is less involvement and less building, or less solid building, of that thing that my mind is struggling with, clinging to, pulling towards me or pushes away. So this is in a way a very... this is something that can be seen in a very deep level, very subtle level in meditation, also in daily life. It's like there is this person, you know, and you don't really like them. And there's a day in the office and you need to go, and there's this person, you're thinking about them, or you're meeting this group, and then there's this person, you're thinking about them, and your mind is very much involved in creating how that person is for you, you know. And if you're honest, you can sense that. I'm projecting things, I'm creating things. There is an involvement of the mind in whatever I'm clinging to, pulling towards me or pushes away. And that involvement of the mind, and that's the second principle, doesn't only creates the way in which I perceive this or that thing, but also the amount of that thing for me. You know? So let's say that right in the end of this retreat there is something you're very worried about, really, really worried about, or really looking forward to, doesn't matter. The last couple of hours of this retreat, you know, the last half an hour, whatever, one, it may be very much colored by your sense of what's going to happen and your fear or projection or expectation, whatever, but also the heaviness and intensity of time, of each second, of each minute, you know, and maybe you can feel that in meditation when things are kind of going hard and you're quite agitated. Time is going by very, very slowly. The amount is being built more. Or this person that you have some allergic response towards. And I know this from myself, of course. Allergic response. it's not only that the way I perceive them is colored by my mind, but also they, for some reason, become a very dominant person in my life. Quite unfortunately, you know, at least for that day, or more generally. The mind creates both the way and also the amount in which something is sensed and perceived. And when it is seen in deep meditation, in more subtle levels, it can bring, or not only, also in the daily sort of level, it can bring to quite interesting and profound insight about the nature of reality as something that is built, as something that is constructed, as something that the mind participates not only in the way it is appears for me, but also in its very appearance. The fact that something appears for me, for my mind, is actually dependent on the mind's activity, on the creation of this or that thing. Now, that does not mean that that thing does not exist in any way. But the boundary between its existence and what my mind creates is a very, very interesting question. Very interesting question. Very mysterious, not obvious at all, at all. So this is how you see the emptiness of things. Did that make sense to you? No way it did. Maybe it did. I didn't. Now another question would be why? Like, why would you even want to see the emptiness of something? To see the emptiness of all things? Like, why is that even a thing? Why is that interesting? I think there are many reasons for that. Many, many reasons. And all these great spiritual teachers, especially from the Buddhist tradition, pointing to the importance of the seeing of the emptiness of things as a key to awakening. I don't think they were wrong. And I don't think they were just talking. And I think one reason or one angle on the reason why one would want to see the emptiness of things or even have a desire or longing to see and understand the emptiness of things has to do with the relationship between emptiness and love. And perhaps especially, more particularly, I say, about emptiness and how it makes you see and meet another being, another person. When I thought of this talk, I remembered the way I sensed the presence and listening of my teacher here in the library many times, actually. So I want to tell you a little bit about that, and then I'll make the generalization, theoretization of it. It was really interesting to meet him, because it was clear I had another teacher early in my days of practice, and he spoke about his teacher. And he said, when I met my teacher, I looked into his eyes, and it's as if his eyes were like, older teacher of mine said, and his eyes were like an ocean, were like a vast, vast ocean, or vast space. With Rob, it wasn't exactly like that. Honestly, like there was something of it. But I felt that his depth wasn't just like the depth of ocean or the depth of space, but actually his depth and his presence was there was a lot of fire in them, quite a lot of fire in them. And it wasn't a fire that was trying to pin me down or convince me in a certain direction or get something from me, if that makes sense. But it was like a fire, and it was steady, but it wasn't fixed, if that makes sense. You know, it was quite flexible and malleable and responsive, very, very responsive to what was happening in the situation, to how I was at that time. And I know from other students that that wasn't unique to his meeting with me. But it was as if that fire was looking at me and saw through whatever was fixed and stagnated and sort of just held with doubt or uncertainty, and looked for and found and could communicate with what was fundamentally important and possible in ways that I didn't necessarily knew or realized or believed that were possible. Does this make sense to you? And I found that whatever there was there in me that could resonate with that fire did resonate with it and was ignited by it. And I think also the last point I thought of with regards to this fire, I remembered with regards to this fire, that in it, in the way he looked at me and asked for my potential to show themselves sort of beyond the boundaries of doubt and limitation and sort of naive beliefs in what is real and what is unreal, because all this was deeply embedded in understanding of emptiness, and I'll say something about that later, there was also an implied speech or an implied something saying that it is for you, but it's also for you to be able to serve well. Seeing that these potentials that will be ignited and communicate with this fire are not only for your welfare and happiness, they are, but they're also in order for you to be able to serve well, because these potentials are more than yourself. Now, why am I telling you all that? Besides, oh, it's interesting and inspiring in some way. Because I think a really interesting question is the question, what makes a person be able to listen, approach, and love in this way? Is this not an interesting question? What makes a person be equipped, have the possibility to listen and tune in and meet another person in this way, with this kind of... What is it? I think it has anything to do with deep understanding of emptiness. Or everything? It has... What?
Everything.
Everything. It has everything to do with deep understanding of emptiness. It has a lot of things in it too, of course, like deep development of the Brahmaviharas, amazing emotional attunement and relational attunement. A very dedicated cultivation of samadhi and many more things. But I think at the heart of it, and this correlates with his presentation of his views as well, at the heart of it, there is a deep understanding of the emptiness of things. because it's like, how can you look directly at something or someone without pushing, I don't want this, or pulling, I want this from you, you know? Not looking from the perspective of the self-interest and not looking away. Really not looking away. Like, how can it be that a person can look at you and see not from the perspective of their own self-interest and from a place of pushing and pulling without you needing to hide or their sort of not really looking? I think it has everything to do with the sense of I'm looking at something there and I perceive it, I communicate with it, it says something to me, it's meaningful to me, but at the same time, I do not decide, I do not know in a way how it is. I know it's, let's say, more fundamental reality without knowing or that can dissolve its apparent reality, if that makes sense, or make me or allow me not to buy into the apparent reality, because apparent reality is always in communication with our habitual pushing and pulling. I don't have the quote here, but there are places in which Nagarjuna say wherever there isn't an understanding of emptiness, suffering coming from reactivity and pushing and pulling are inevitable. Whatever, however way you fixate a person or reify them, pushing and pulling will come to the picture. Because this is what makes us reify. When the Buddha was asked how the Buddha will appear after death, what's going to happen to them? He didn't really answer this question, but he did answer it, you know, and he said to the person asking, the person was called Anuradha, and he said to the person asking, well, he actually gave that person practice, to look at the Buddha in a certain way. Look at me in a certain way. A way that actually we can take, learn, and practice on other people as well, and on ourselves. So we can take the practice that the Buddha suggested and apply it to ourselves and to others. Or a certain interpretation of that practice, and this is called the Sevenfold Reasoning. I definitely not going to present it now. It's possible to do. So that person asked the Buddha, like, what's going to happen with you? And the Buddha told him, well, look at me this way, you know, don't look at me this way, and you will see that you can't even find me now. You're looking at me, but you cannot find me. I'm neither here nor there. You cannot pin me down. That's the quote. You cannot pin him, the Tathagata, Buddha was speaking about himself, you cannot pin him down. And we can learn to look this way at others, on others, and on ourselves. Very much sense into without knowing. In any reified way. Does that sound attractive to you? Looking into, being extremely sensitive to, without knowing in any reified way, ourselves and others. And in this way, love is not limited. Just not limited. I remember Christopher coming to a visit in Israel. Christopher Titus lives nearby. Coming to a visit in Israel, and one of the practitioners, one of the yogis, asked them, who's a work yogi, asked Christopher, asked him, what's the fruit of the path? You know, speak about the path of liberation, the path of practice. What's the fruit of the path? And Christopher's response was, it's unstoppable friendship. Unstoppable friendship. And that's a nice response, isn't it? I think he was pointing to a similar thing. When you sense someone, something, and you don't pin them down, and you don't look away, love is very natural. More natural than in any other way, I think. So, how can we start looking at, seeing and sensing the emptiness of others? I think the question, the answer for me right now will begin with finding a more comfortable way to sit, so I'll change the posture. I think when I'll be less busy seeing the emptiness of my knee pain, I'll be more available to see the emptiness of you. Yeah, much more empty now. Sorry. So how can we start begin to see the emptiness of others? There are many ways to do that. And we couldn't... There are many ways to do that. But if we'll remain loyal to the main road of dependent origination, then the answer is relatively simple and straightforward. Starting to see others as dependent origination. What does that mean? Seeing that the appearance of others for us is dependent on our way of looking, on what our mind and heart, and how our mind and heart are participating in our experience of them. And in it, we can be especially sensitive to activities that our heart and mind are habitually doing that build and create the sense of who we are and who others are in habitual, automatic ways that we believe to be real. And we can be especially interested as well in finding ways to decrease these activities. Decrease these activities, these automatic activities of mind and heart that makes us fixed and makes others fixed for us. Finding a place of rest from these activities. You know, when you can see it, when you start to teach a retreat, especially a slightly longer one, you know, people are entering into the hall, and you can see that there are all sorts of dynamics between them. You know, with English people, it's slightly less clear. With Israelis, it's obvious. Honestly, it's like you can tell exactly who is in love with who and who hates who. Maybe English can read, English people can read English people better, you know, but my reading of Israel is much, and I think they're generally maybe a little more easier to read in this way. And that lasts, that goes on, you know, for a few days, but then at the end of the retreat, you know, and in the retreat, no interaction between the people, at least formally and hopefully, you know. People are busy in their own practice, busy doing exactly that, reducing the activities of constructing, of building self and other in solid, rigid ways. not through the direct interaction with others, but through the interaction and the practice with one's own heart, reducing these activities. Let's say one can practice allowing and welcoming whatever is in one's field of experience, and just hold that for a few days, allowing, welcoming, whatever arises, whatever appears, just welcome. One can do that, not really relating to others, not really looking at others, and then after a few days one will open the eyes and sit in a circle, and it's like, whoa, thank you, you know, you all have been so helpful for my retreat, so important for my retreat, you know. What happened there? What happened there? There was no relational work, in the obvious sense of the word, but something shifted in the heart, and therefore in the perception and experience of who others are. Isn't it? When we're not creating false boundaries, false identities, or rigid ones, through the very habitual pushing and pulling of the heart, we will experience ourselves and others very differently. Friendship will be very natural. Compassion, very natural. Rumi has a really nice story. So it's one of these roomy sort of complex stories with all sorts of twists and what's going on here? I'm not sure. You know? But the short version is a father of a family died, and his request was to give all his wealth and fortune to his laziest son. Not saying who the laziest son was. So the three kids of this now grown-up people, actually, but the three sons of this person went to the judge, and the judge needed to decide who's the laziest. So there was a competition going on. Each one had to prove his laziness, and I won't describe the whole process there. He does say in the beginning of the process, he does say quite beautifully, mystics are experts in laziness. They rely on it. The harvest keep coming in, yet they never even did the plowing. So mystics are experts in laziness. And what does that mean? Does it mean that mystics sit around not doing anything all day? Maybe. That would make us very bad mystics. I think what he means, or what he may mean, is that this laziness of allowing the mind and heart to stop doing what the mind and hearts of more ordinary people, or people in more ordinary states, are doing all the time, which is constructing self and other in solid, rigid ways. So mystics are experts in laziness. They rely on it. The harvest keep coming in, yet they never even did the plowing. And then the judge, it's a quote. The judge then asked the youngest brother, "What if a man cannot be made to say anything? How do you learn his hidden nature?" So that's the riddle, or that's the challenge the judge place. You look at another person. How do you see its hidden nature if they're not saying anything? I can add that I think that if they are saying anything, it's much harder than when they're not saying anything. It's actually much easier to do. And then the younger brother says, I sit in front of him in silence and set up a ladder made of patience. And if in his presence a language from beyond and joy, and if in his presence a language from beyond, I sit in front of him in silence and set up a ladder made of patience. And if in his presence a language from beyond joy and beyond grief begin to pour from my chest, I know that his soul is as deep and bright as the star Canopus rising over Yemen. So when I start speaking, a powerful right arm of words sweeping down, I know him from what I say and how I say it, because there is a window open between us, mixing up the night air in our beings. Or mixing up the night air of our beings. So setting up a ladder of patience, and then a language from beyond joy and beyond grief comes. And then word or language pours. And a window is open between us and the night air. It's flowing there. Okay, thank you for listening. Maybe we'll sit together for 2 minutes. Just sensitive to your own field of the body and really trusting it. And the invitation now for this minute and maybe for the walking period is opening to this sensitivity to the whole body and taking a stance of welcoming, really deeply welcoming everything that arises in the experience, inner and outer. Really, whatever is there, every form of sensation, bodily, forms of mental sensations, and experiences. Sounds. Really opening the door and welcoming. In the walking, you would probably need to do that again and again. Remind yourself that all of this is welcome. Do enjoy the walk. Where's the bell? So maybe we'll meet back here at 11. So if you can ring a few minutes before that. Thank you. Of course, if you wish to stay seated, you're welcome to as well.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.